Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. This is the morning after the final presidential debate, and we are joined by the Bulwark's own Tim Miller. Tim, you stayed up late to watch that, right?
Wasn't that late on the West Coast. Yeah, no, it was a very reasonable time. I stayed up and watched it. And I have to tell you, Charlie, I have to agree with the pundits. The president really improved off of the first debate. He didn't give anybody the novel coronavirus last night, I noticed. He didn't defend white nationalists even.
This is a step up. No, as I said in my newsletter this morning, I mean, his head didn't rotate 180 degrees and have green projectile vomit. So, new tone. All hail new tone. this was the pivot. I mean, it is a little bit like, you know, with Donald Trump, there is I'm going to mix metaphors now, the Stockholm syndrome of the media, that they're just looking for just some moment like, okay, so it wasn't totally awful. I suppose it's like, you know, growing up in a household where you have an abusive alcoholic dad, and those nights when he doesn't come home drunk and beats up mom, you're going, he's the best dad in the world. Really, this is better.
I think that's exactly right. And here's the other, I think in addition to that, Charlie, like just as a practical level, I think people like our brains have been broken by the last 5 years, and people like forget what a normal president is supposed to act like. Right. The number of people who last night were like, oh, this was a relatively normal debate between two people. And I was like, not really, it wasn't.
By our standards.
I mean, maybe it felt normal as compared to, you know, Nazi defense and, you know, kind of like throwing feces at one another on the stage. But no, it was not the standard behavior.
So before we get into all of this, I just want to thank all the folks who have signed up for Bulwark Plus. We did a live stream after the debate last night, which was a lot of fun. We'll be posting that as well. It was Bill Kristol, Mona Charon, Sarah Longwell, and I. People were asking about Tim. They were saying, you know, why are we stuck with the olds? Where's Tim Miller? So you're going to be on the next one. You're going to be on election night. I assume we're going to be doing that as well. So, but I mean, for the Bulwark Plus, I'm having a hard time keeping up with all the stuff that we're doing at the Bulwark. I mean, really, I'm actually not kidding. That if you sign up for Bulwark Plus, you not only get this podcast, there's the secret podcast, there's the Next Level podcast. You are invited to the live streams. You continue to get my Morning Shots newsletter. You get JVL's Triad newsletter, including Tim. You've been doing that every Sunday. So you've been, that's a 6 day a week sort of thing. And plus, you're doing this Snapchat thing brought to you by the Bulwarks. I mean, you know, which is not for the olds, by the way.
No, that's not. Yeah, it's so nice to hang out with you guys. And, you know, as I come up on middle age here, that I get considered to be with the youngs, because I'm like over double the age of the median viewer of the Snapchat show. JVL told me in Slack, this really hurt my feelings. This was months ago. It's still lingering. So you can see how much it hurt my feelings. He said that, Tim, most of the viewers of your Snapchat show don't see a difference between you and Bill Kristol. That's just true. Both old. So anyway, I do appreciate to spend time with people who think that I'm bringing the hipness. But the Snapchat show is killing it. We have, I just looked, yesterday's episode already has 160,000 some odd views.
Oh, that is fantastic. Yeah. Okay, let's start off because we're going to get to the debate, and also, I actually had a moment last night. My newsletter is already out, so I'm not giving anything away here. But after the debate, after our live stream, I'm taking the dogs out in the driveway. It's raining, and we're going back and forth, and it hit me: this thing's over. Okay, and we'll come back to whether you agree, because I'm not usually that optimistic. And I said that's the last time I'm ever going to have to watch Donald Trump in a presidential debate, probably. So we'll get to that.
Wrong.
Okay.
Wrong.
Okay, you're thinking 2024 already?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. I know where you're at. Okay. News quiz. When you were a kid, did you always do the news quiz on Fridays and over the weekends?
I don't think so. As a young adult, I did the Slate news quiz for a while.
So you're a news quiz guy. I figured you were. Okay, so who is Maria Bakalova?
Maria Bakalova.
This is a name we need to know.
It is?
Yeah.
Maria Bakalova. I don't know.
She is the actress in the Borat movie who gets...
Like, I knew that name.
Giuliani on the bed.
I was going through Ukraine, not Kazakhstan. In my head, I was like going through all the names in the Ukraine extended universe. And I was like, I don't remember a woman.
No, she's the what's fascinating today is that we're actually getting Zapruder level film analysis, shot by shot of what was Rudy doing, how far down was the hand, was he really just tucking in his shirt? So this is 2020. This is one of those things. So Trivial Pursuit, Maria Bakalova. The other name is, how do you pronounce it? Babalusky?
Babalinsky.
Babalinsky.
Yeah.
He was supposed to be the big star of last night, right?
Yeah, I think it was our friend Christian Vanderbrook that said this. I'm stealing this. It's like, Trump came into last night. He brought him to the debate. It was supposed to be, you know, his big thing to shake Joe Biden. And it was going to be this memorable name, kind of like the Comey letter for 2020. Yep. And Christian said, well, in some ways he's right, because Babalinsky will be remembered, because in, you know, we will use him in future presidential campaigns as an example of a failed gambit. You know, anytime a candidate tries to bring up something ridiculous that doesn't work, it'll be a Babalinsky.
That's right. It will be. Now, for people who are not totally online, I'm guessing that this, you know, the president wanted to
only don't read the Wall Street Journal's competing articles on him.
If they wanted to, you know, the president wanted to be all about Babalinsky, and of course tens of millions of voices crying out, who is this guy? He's the guy who's obviously a disgruntled, pissed off former associate of Hunter Biden, who had some emails and gone full Trump and said that he was present when they were discussing the business and all of this. And this was going to be the big dramatic moment, which failed spectacularly. And, you know, you mentioned the Wall Street Journal. I mean, have you ever seen anything like what the Wall Street Journal did?
So I can't remember.
They come out. We can't assume that everybody is online as we are. So Kimberly Strassel, who is a Trump fluffer over there, comes out with this big opinion piece. It's in the opinion section, where she's trying to make the case of, you know, the Babalinsky, you know, papers and Hunter Biden and all of this stuff. And this is their big scoop. And within, it felt like minutes, the news department of the Wall Street Journal comes out with its own dueling article that basically says that whole story is bullshit, just debunks the whole thing, that there's no evidence that Biden had anything to do with any of this. I mean, just slam dunks the whole thing.
And it wasn't just news. It's this whole Murdoch universe internal fights. It wasn't just the Wall Street Journal. I don't know if you saw this because it came out pretty late last night. But a Fox News reporter I'm not familiar with, Jackie Heinrich. Did you see this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So she read all of the emails, which we all can't read, you know, because they've only been leaked to Murdoch properties. And said that, you know, this whole claim that the chairman is Biden is not true. It becomes clear that the chairman is actually China. It's a shorthand for talking about China. That Biden himself, Joe Biden, has no roles in the emails or the documents. That there are no other members in the in this company than Hunter and his business partners, not Joe. And I went on her feed and I just noticed her last tweet before this was making clear that the Proud Boys, you know, sort of that ham-handed Proud Boys, you know, email, intimidation email thing that came from other countries was intended to help President Trump, which is the opposite of what Ratcliffe said, potentially by exacerbating disputes around the results. So anyway, I don't know Jackie Heinrich, but these are the only two tweets I've seen and got good honor.
Well, it is interesting when you think about it, because there were reporters from the New York Post, speaking of Murdoch world, who also were doubting the provenance of the hard drive. And clearly there's a fight going on within Fox News and which refused to run with the story because they had credibility problems. And now you have the Wall Street Journal civil war over all of this. But I did see one analysis from Politico. So one of the winners last night was Hunter Biden, because none of this stuff, you know, worked. And it really was one of those moments where you realize Donald Trump really has created this alternative reality bubble, that if you really haven't been marinating in Fox News and all of this stuff, you probably had no idea what he was talking about most of the time.
Yeah, I think that that's, well, I mean, not most of the time, but there was a huge section there. And I thought, you know, Kristen did a great job last night. So credit to her.
She really did.
Yeah. But this is my one. I have two nitpicks. And we'll get to the other one later. The first one is this Hunter thing came up way too early in the debate. They spent like 20 minutes. It felt like 20 minutes. I don't know how. I didn't actually time it. Right after the coronavirus section. I do think that it was completely confusing. If Trump got anything out of this, it's hard for me since I am so deep in this stuff to like, but I'm sitting there trying to like put my head in the position of my mother, you know, and be like, what is she interpreting from these exchanges? But I think he might have had some success at just kind of creating a muddying the waters on this issue of corruption when in reality, as we know, it's such a clear cut case. I mean, and this is the thing that's frustrating me as somebody who does know the details here. I'm sitting on the couch just screaming at my television, like Trump is claiming that Biden was taking money while he was in the White House, which is not true. He's released all 8 years of his tax returns from the White House. You can see exactly how much money he made. He did not take foreign money. And meanwhile, Donald Trump is taking money from many foreign sources, including specifically Turkey, right now, and accusing Biden of it. And so like that was frustrating because he did manage, I think, to sort of, you know, maybe get it to a draw on this point, which is not what he needs to win the election, of course. But I guess that might have been, you know, some strategic point to him on that score. But overall, it certainly was not this silver bullet where it was a very clear corruption message like you had with Hillary.
So There was one moment that I'm kind of fixated about, and it, okay. You know, the Trump's obsession with Hunter and the laptop and Bob Alinsky, really, even though it didn't work as well as he was hoping it would, it does explain why he's losing this race. And I really thought that one moment kind of captured this shift. And David Frum highlighted this as well in The Atlantic, that Trump erupted in sneering sarcasm when Joe Biden summoned the image of middle-class families at the kitchen table. The very idea of it irked Trump. Let me play this. A minute 20 of what I thought was an incredibly revealing exchange.
Now we have a steel.
Okay, industry. Vice President Biden, your response, please.
My response is, look, this isn't about, there's a reason why he's bringing up all this malarkey. There's a reason for it. He doesn't want to talk about the substantive issues. It's not about his family and my family. It's about your family. And your family's hurting badly. If you're making less than, if you're a middle-class family, you're getting hurt badly right now. You're sitting at the kitchen table this morning deciding, well, we can't get new tires, they're bald because we have to wait another month or so. Or are we going to be able to pay the mortgage? Or who's going to tell her she can't go back to community college? They're the decisions you're making in the middle-class families like I grew up in Scranton and Claymont. They're in trouble. We should be talking about your families, but that's the last thing he wants to talk about.
I want to talk about North Korea.
10 seconds. Political statement. Let's get off this China thing. And then he looks, the family, around the table, everything. Just a typical politician when I see that.
Let's talk
I'm
about North
I'm not a
typical
Korea politician.
Okay,
that's why I got elected.
Let's
get off the subject of China. Let's talk around sitting around the table.
All right.
Come on, Joe. You can do better.
We're going to talk about North Korea now. President Trump.
Wow. Are you old enough to remember when Trump billed himself as the voice of the forgotten man?
I am.
Go on.
I'm so happy that that was the clip because I thought that that was a very revealing moment in the cesspool that is Twitter.com last night, because you got to see who has just become so jaded by the last 5 years that they thought Trump won on that point. I mean, like, some decently reasonable people were like, oh,
really?
Trump really? Yeah. I was just like scrolling. I'm like, what? Like, Trump called Joe Biden out on his politician speak. And I just saw that as totally the opposite, as Biden getting exactly back to the point after 20 minutes of nonsense about bank accounts and Ukraine and, you know, Bob Alinsky and Hunter, and nobody even could follow. Biden, I thought, let that conversation go on too long, if anything. And then, you know, finally turned back and, you know, said, look at this guy. And he did that very well in the first debate. You can tell that was something that they worked on. And again, you know, I'm a Excel bubble, coastal elite bubble guy here. So, you know, I don't want to pretend like I can get in the head of, you know, your swing voter in Mechanicsburg. But to me, that's Joe at least signaling to them that he actually cares about them.
Oh,
while
absolutely.
Donald is signaling that actually, no, he just doesn't. All he cares about is like his little, you know, spat fights and, you know, all the details of the Ukrainian, you know, oppo research dump. And he doesn't actually care about
well, and how unfair, you know, yeah. the IRS was to him and all these terrible things that happened. So, I mean, if you were looking for a flash of empathy, you were obviously watching the wrong channel, right?
Yeah.
See, I mean, here's the thing about this forgotten American was really at the heart of his, yes. of his appeal. Now, you know, obviously somewhat unfairly or insincerely, whatever, but the whole point of 4 years ago was that he was going to channel and stoke the anger and the concerns, right, of the average American in Michigan and in Wisconsin. And what you got from him last night was, yeah, screw that. I want to talk about myself. I mean, here's a guy who's always been in his own sort of narcissistic bubble, but he's really created this alternative reality now that has insulated himself from what's happening in his own country. So he's up there and he's talking about turning the corner and living with the pandemic the day after we have 70,000 new cases, 1,000 people dying a day, millions of people still out mm-hmm. of work. But they're not his problem. He doesn't want to talk about them. He wants to talk about Hunter Biden's freaking laptop. He wants to compare himself to Abraham Lincoln. You know, he wants sympathy for all the mean things that have been done to him. And don't tell him stories about average Americans who might not be able to afford stuff because – when's the last time he sat around the table and worried about whether or not he was going to be able to afford this or that?
Yeah, never. I mean, it was all phony in 2016, but he had Bannon around him, who I think helped keep his North Star. And he was able to focus on his grievances about how the Obama administration and the Bush administration had failed, you know, Americans. He didn't have to defend his own record. He's such a sensitive Sally that he just can't help but like complain and whine about himself and woe is me rather than focus on, you know, anymore pretend to focus on the problems of regular people. But I just, the other thing on this point, Charlie, and I think this got lost in some of the commentary out of last night, is the other thing that Joe Biden was really good on last night, the thing that he was the best on, in my opinion, was later in the debate, getting back to those kitchen table issues mm-hmm. around the stimulus and around the yes. minimum wage hike. And again, you know, these Obama-Trump voters, not all, you know, some of them are gone. Some of them are just in this cult, have just gone full Breitbart and, you know, Red Hat and are in the cultural grievance lane now. But a lot of them, you know, really were you know, people that felt let down by the last two presidencies and thought Trump was going to be a businessman who cared about them. There are people out there, I know that they might not be listening to the Bulwark podcast, that bought it and thought he was going to cut deals for them. He hasn't. I thought Biden's golf, you're in the sand trap, not making deals with Pelosi on this was good. Calling him out on the minimum wage hike, not recognizing that under $15 is not a living wage, regardless of what you know, think about the policy dispute there. On a message standpoint, I mean, I thought Biden knocked that out of the park last night, and that was I think that's a key demo that he's talking to.
Well, I did think that Biden seemed sharper than he did in the first debate, and again, you know, things are moving so quickly. But when you think about the hundreds of millions of dollars that the Trump campaign has blown convincing people or trying to convince people that Joe Biden was completely senile, that he couldn't put together a coherent sentence. I mean, remember when Rush Limbaugh was speculating that he couldn't possibly have delivered the acceptance speech at the Democratic convention live because it was too good? You know, I mean, all these conspiracy theories, he must have had something in his ear and on all of that.
And his eyes, the contact lenses, he had those contact lenses that were projecting.
He was sharp, and that's relevant in and of itself. So look,
just really quick on that. This is it's a Sarah's lane with the focus groups. But I dip in and out of those from time to time. And I'll tell you, one of the big things holding back a lot of these Obama-Trump voter types for going back to Biden was the so-called dementia issue, you know, the senility. Like they brought that up way, way more than Hunter. And Tim Alberta, I was reading something that he wrote the other day where he said the same thing. And, you know, in Michigan, he hears about the dementia and the senility thing way more than any of these other nonsense, you know, Fox News navel-gazing scandals. And I think that, you know, Biden, again, some of these people are just looking for an excuse not to vote for him.
Right.
But for those who really wanted to go there, but that was the thing that was holding them back, over two debates, he certainly, you know, swept that issue off the table. And so that was his other big success.
Well, also. Look, I mean, before this began, if we were having this conversation, you know, I think that the fair analysis would be that Joe Biden needed not to melt down. He needed not to, you know, start screaming at the sky or doing something. And he not only did not melt down, he not only did not make a major gaffe. We can talk about the oil industry a little bit later, but which I don't think was really a gaffe. But he actually looked pretty good. And I think that was really important. I think that's one of those things. I sometimes say that, you know, we analyze the lyrics when a lot of voters are listening to the melody, and you know, we're parsing what he should have said or did say or what position he took on this issue. I think the fact that he looked pretty good was significant. So, give me your sense on this. Now, let me tell you, going back to my walk with the dog in the reins last night, I was thinking about. This, of course, was the last chance to change the trajectory. We have a double-digit campaign. I know it's closer in the swing in the swing states, but you know, JVL had a piece yesterday, and we know that he's our resident pessimist, right? I mean, he's the resident Eeyore.
He is, which is very strange because we're kind of a site full of Eeyores, and so it's to his great credit that he's able to elevate above the. Exactly. Above the rest of the group.
So he had two data points that came out yesterday. Number one, the Gallup poll that asked, does President Trump deserve to be reelected? Gallup found 56% no, 43% said yes. That's death for an incumbent when you have that kind of majority. And the second bit of information, he said is worse. The guys from 538 are now projecting a turnout, total number of votes between 144 million and 165 million, with their pin set at about 154 million. And his analysis is, look, anything above 144 million is just, it's really bad news for Trump, because the higher the turnout, the more likely the polls are to be accurate. And so you're looking at a, you know, huge number of votes out there that's really hard to imagine. That, I mean, we'll basically swamp the Trump base. You know, give me your reaction to that, because he's saying, you know, he's toast, he's done. And I felt afterwards with that and seeing the trends that are going, and the fact that you're not going to get the October surprise. I mean, it could still happen, but Trump's kind of finished.
I'm going to out Eeyore him a little bit.
Okay.
And we scrapped a little bit on this on the Next Level podcast, so I'll summarize that here. I think that, generally speaking, his turnout analysis is correct. Like, generally speaking, a bigger turnout is going to accrue to Biden's benefit. Certainly in the popular vote, I think if you want to sell me on the fact that the popular vote race is pretty much done in Biden's favor, outside something, you know, completely crazy, I think that's an argument that I would take. I still have nagging worry about the Electoral College on two points. One is big turnout. If it disproportionately ticks towards, you know, rural, exurban, white working class males, that's a bigger category of non-voters than Zoomers and young millennials and voters of color.
Okay, like, are you seeing any evidence that's happening?
No, not early, but my point is that, like, a lot of those voters have been listening to the, you know, anti mail-in ballot propaganda coming out of the Trump world and MAGA media, so that surge could happen on election day. So I worry about that, and I worry about particularly that surge coming on election day combined with mail-in ballot issues, particularly in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. You know, particularly in Pennsylvania, where They're not used to doing these mail-in ballots. We're already seeing, you know, multiple controversies related to the count. So, you know, if you look at the map, Wisconsin, Michigan feel pretty done. Arizona, okay, but then you got to win another one. And I do, and you know, Florida has been resistant to this wave. Florida was resistant in 2018. When all the other states moved, North Carolina, you know, isn't Virginia yet. So anyway, I think that things look very good. So I agree with that. But because of, you know, the potential, the electoral college demographic difference from the national demographic.
Okay, so that's something that worries me. What are you most worried about when you get up and you look at which states are you most worried about?
Pennsylvania. So he's up by 4 or 5. But you know, if there's a turnout boost in all of the rest of the state besides Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, and Philly on election day, and then we have some mail-in ballot, you know, ballots getting thrown out, that worries me. I think that North Carolina and Florida are lean Biden right now. And so could they break to being clear Biden victories? They could, right? But could there be, again, an election day turnout in kind of all of these other counties? Look, in 2016, not to give everybody PTSD, but in 2016, I remember seeing the Miami number come in.
Yep.
And I was texting Mark Caputo, who's, you know, who knows this stuff better than anybody, and I was like, this seems done to me, right? And he's like,
oh
yeah.
Man, I said the same thing exactly at the same moment.
Yeah, and he's like, yeah, like, you know, there's a lot more vote out in the rest of Florida than you realized. And boy, was he right, and was I wrong on that? And so those are the sort of Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida. He needs one of them. He could win all three, by the way. He could win Georgia, by the way. I mean, I think that JVL's breakdown is right in the sense that I think that there's a big, that the range of outcomes is from like a very narrow Trump squeak, thanks to some help with thrown out ballots in Pennsylvania, all the way to, you know, a 400 electoral vote landslide. I think that's possible, but, you know, I'd like for the chance to be 0%, and I'm not feeling 0% right now.
Yeah, I mean, it is possible given the dynamics. And again, I don't want to give anybody PTSD because I do think this is over, and I've said that. But you can certainly imagine, and it sort of emotionally resonates that, you know, if in fact North Carolina is a coin flip, imagine that, you know, easily imagine Trump actually eking out a win in North Carolina and in Florida, and if there are problems in Pennsylvania, and then you're back at 2016. Arizona is not, you know, totally nailed down. So, yeah, Biden could win in Wisconsin, could win in Michigan, and still not win this election.
Right.
So people do need to understand that. But I think, you know, part of it is that there are the atmospherics of all of this, and I wonder just how much of our analysis is just totally haunted by that experience of 2016, which I'm still haunted by. I mean, I can still feel the emotions when you just described how you felt when you saw the Miami vote from 2016. I remember I'm down here in the basement. I have all the computers all set up and I'm looking at the Florida numbers, and I walked up to my wife. One of our friends was here, and I said, I think this thing is over. It's over in Florida because look at what the numbers are out of Miami. And I remember that feeling, and I also then remember sitting and watching that damn needle.
Yeah, I know. It is. The haunting is real. And you know, my friend Peter Hamby wrote a great Vanity Fair piece, if listeners want to check that out, where he basically, you know, lands in the JVL camp and says that this has been a static race since June, and if anything, you know, there's a bigger chance of Biden winning in Georgia than in losing. And that could be right. I mean, he is more dispassionate than me about this. I definitely admit that my emotions and the scars, the very, very thick scars from 2016 might be clouding, you know, my ability to look at this dispassionately. But,
well, And one of the major factors, though, that feels so different about this year is that in 2016, no one thought he could win. And that, you know, nobody imagined he would win. So the level of motivation, particularly among Democrats in Wisconsin, much lower than I think it is right now. also you had a lot of the third parties out there, and it was a free vote to, you know, to vote for Jill Stein or to vote for, you know, Evan McMullen or yes. to vote for the Libertarian. This year, the people who voted third party in 2016 are breaking very strongly for Biden. So you had undecided
voters. Very strongly,
voters,
very heavily.
Very, yeah, they are. So.
Yeah, no, the third party thing has been big. Anytime I get nervous, I think about the third party as part of this, because Biden really can win this thing just through the third party, you know, just through that. Like, if that Nate Cohn poll showed Biden in the Midwest up, I think, 34 points, I'm going from memory, among people who voted third party.
That's amazing.
In these states. Yeah, it was Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Iowa. And if that is true, you know, Joe Biden's the president, if nothing else changed, you know, all else being equal, and the third party vote breaks 34% to him, he wins. Like, he doesn't need anything else. He doesn't need to win back any more Obama Trump voters. He doesn't need to turn out any more black voters or young voters. He doesn't need to win over any more, you know, never Trump Republicans. Like, he can just win with that. And so one thing I keep reminding myself.
And then you have
Biden's number is higher than Hillary's ever was, like his right. ballot number.
And the olds. I mean, let's face it. The yeah. most reliable voters in the world are senior citizens. And Trump won among senior citizens. And senior citizens are breaking for Biden. And I think they're pissed on the coronavirus. So I'm sitting here in Wisconsin right now. And all of the news is dominated by the spike in the coronavirus cases, what's happening to the hospitals. I mean, this is a big story. And if people in Wisconsin are tuning in and watching the president's answer on coronavirus, he had nothing. He had nothing new. It's like, everything's fine. We're learning to live with it. People are going, whoa, whoa, whoa. We're freaking out here. We're going into the third spike. We're going into the flu season here. This is bad. And the president's basically saying, yeah, you know what, herd immunity type thing. And it's like, well, you know, that means the grandmas, you know, might have to go. This is not working. So I'm thinking again.
I just really quick on that, yeah. because we really should have started with this. Yeah. We're 40 minutes in. Like, his answer on the virus for the first segment of last night's debate, yes. Trump's answer, horrific, mm. horrific, not in tune with what the polls say, not in tune with the spirit of the country. It is in tune only with the, you know, death cult members that show up to his rallies. You know, and this is not like, there is even a big portion of the, not the old line Republican base, you and me, of the Trump base that thinks he's crazy on this. So like, the, you know, particularly seniors, older, you know, people who are people who have experienced deaths related to the virus. So he had no answer for what his plan was. His plan is totally wish casting. It's the same plan it's been since day one. It's going to go away. We'll get it better. We're going to get a vaccine. We might bleach people. I mean, it, like, that answer was a nightmare. And I do feel like, you know, to your point about how we all get wrapped up in the atmospherics and we have to talk about this and that and the tone and you know, we become figure skating judges. The main thing about this election is this pandemic. And mm-hmm. his answer to that last night was atrocious.
Well, and I'm thinking about 11 days to go in the election, because isn't this the marker where James Comey came out yes. and announced it? So the 11 days out. So we know that there can be something 11 days out that can change everything. So this is another one of those days where you've had a PTSD pin stuck in it, because you remember you woke up, you know, 4 years ago, and this race was done. And by the time you went to bed, everything was turned around. But
yeah, I was so deep in my like epistemic bubble of denial that Trump could win that I didn't even think the Comey letter was a big deal. So I do need to check myself on that. But 4 years ago. But yes, this is the same.
Well, because day. We thought it was unthinkable, and, therefore impossible.
Yeah, and we've had many more votes now. So that's different also. And that happened 11 days ago, but. You know, in a lot of these states, double the votes have been cast as at this time last year.
Well, the usual formula in politics, correct me if I'm wrong, is that undecided voters tend to break against incumbents. And so that's not good news for Donald Trump. Maybe that's different right now. And as you point out, a lot of votes have already been cast. But this dominant story where every day it gets worse, I mean, I actually was shocked. I had taken my eyes off the dial or whatever for a moment. And when Joe Biden said, and yesterday there were 70,000 new cases, I thought, what? When did we get to 70,000? I mean,
I had the same moment where I just had a second of like, did he get that wrong?
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. Because I remember when Anthony Fauci was saying at one point that going into the fall, we needed to be down around like 7,000 to 10,000 or something. Maybe I'm wrong on that number, but that we really had to be low going in to not have it be terrible. That if we were at, you know, 50,000, we would really, really be in trouble. And now we're at 70,000. So these are the last 11 days of this campaign. And you had that answer from the president when you know that every single day there's going to be a headline about this. It's hard for me to imagine what would cause a major shift of votes to Trump. So it does come down, I'm sorry to say this, but to do what you know, what you mentioned before about the turnout. You know, is there that secret block of, you know, people who have never voted before, these non-college educated, you know, white men? Now, there are some disturbing stories about the success Republicans have had with voter registration. Yep. You watch that?
Mm-hmm.
How bothered should we be about that? Are you how bothered are
again,
you by
I
that?
Again, I mean, I'm bothered by it in the fact that I worry about the electoral map and the voter, the pool of voters. Okay, so the pool of voters who did not vote in 2016 who could be added to the electorate in 2020 nationwide is a benefit to Biden. And these swing states, it's Trump. Okay. Now, again, we don't know exactly, you know, we're not going to have 100% turnout, right? So how does that break down? But I you know, he has a voter reg advantage, ad advantage, both in Florida and in Pennsylvania. I think about 100,000 in each over 2016. And so, you know, and he won Pennsylvania last time by 30. So 130,000 plus you throw out 80,000 naked ballots. That's 210,000.
Yeah,
that's a big number to make up. So I don't have the math in front of me. Like if he goes in with a 4-point lead, is that enough to counteract 210? Probably. But, you know, this was my, I guess while we're just sort of wallowing in the muck here, because you know our website's very optimistic this morning. So if you're just looking for a pick me up, you can go to the website. That was what I last night had this kind of in my gut. I just desired for the kill shot. You know, I just wanted Joe Biden to step on his face, or for Donald Trump to fall on his own face, and particularly on that core issue of you know, character and moral clarity. And I do felt like Trump kind of fought that to a draw. And I felt like Biden, you know, didn't really make the sale on the soul of America case. And I was frustrated by some of the stuff that didn't, you know, Lafayette Square didn't come up. Yeah, Parkland didn't come up. I mean, I felt like if when you add all this stuff together, child separation and Lafayette Square and the white power tweet and Parkland and just his total lack of caring about the people who are dying from the coronavirus, I felt like you could have made a close there that just exposed him. And I don't feel like we got that. We got kind of status quo, which is also good for Biden. But, you know, deep in my bones, I wanted, you know, the Trump's face in the manure. And I didn't get that.
You didn't get in the debate, but right now Joe Biden, and this is again an extraordinary story, is outspending Trump. Yeah. What is it, about 3-1? So you have hundreds of millions of dollars of ads out there making that case. I mean, he is being pounded. Those true. Messages are out there, and they're out there all the time. I've been talking to people around the country who say, you know, every time I turn on the television, there's a Biden ad. I'm not seeing Trump ads, which is exactly the opposite of what we thought we would be seeing right now. Okay, so in the time that we have left, I want to make sure that we give you credit. You had a scoop in the Bulwark yesterday that is being followed by the New York Times, which gives you credit for breaking the story. It's a fascinating story about this congressional seat. This is Mark Meadows' old congressional seat.
Yep.
And the Republican is a interesting character. His name is Madison Cawthorn, and you found a racist website, and tell me the story.
It was one of those things where I didn't think it was real. I put this into the Slack. I had a friend text it to me and said, "Have you seen this?" And then I searched to see if anybody had written about it before. Nobody had. And on this site, Cawthorn was attacking. He claimed it was an advisor to his opponent, Mo Davis, but it turns out it just was this kind of a writer for maybe a more progressive, nonprofit website down there in North Carolina. And he said that this guy, Tom Fieldler, quit his academia job in Boston to work for non-white males like Cory Booker, who aims to ruin white males. And I mean, it was first like the syntax is so bad, and it's just like such an out. It's something out of 1952. You know, it's like where do you even come up with the phrase "goes to work for non-white males"? I mean, how does that even come into your brain that that's like a pejorative? That you would work for the person you went to work for was not a white person. And so we looked around and we found that it was actually his site. He was running Facebook ads to the page. There's some other kind of, typical culture warrior stuff on the page. He attacks him for the Green New Deal, says he's a terrorist sympathizer, says he's perverted. It's a pretty gross website overall, but that line, which read out of Jim Crow, stood out. And so, yeah, we put it up. He's on the bulwark. He's since changed it, but didn't apologize. He said it was, poorly phrased. And I was explicitly racist.
Well, I thought the non-apology was very, very telling, because the right answer was, oh my God, I didn't know that was there. It should never have been there. It was written by some volunteer or something. Not that it was poorly phrased.
And then you've got, this ties to, and it's what I kind of got into in the article, Trump has been doing these attacks on Cory Booker, these dog boys. Yes. So again, this is the same thing. Like the criticism here is this guy went to work for a, quote, non-white male who is Cory Booker. And it's just like, it shows you just how like deep these guys are digging down the white grievance well, that like Cory Booker is the boogeyman that they have come up with here,
Well, also, I mean, for a while it looked like this Madison Cawthorn was going to be the new rising, handsome young man star in the Republican Party. A lot of red flags for this guy. A lot of red flags. But this is a seat that is flippable, I understand.
Yeah, so there's another red flag just worth mentioning, which is why he went after this Tom Fieldler, because he had written about a letter that was written by Cawthorn's classmates from college. He's only 25, so this is like 3 years ago, right? So like a college letter coming out for somebody our age, and they said that he was a serial predator and he got girls into his car and did gross stuff, and so he's got those issues. But he, to your point about being a star, he spoke at the Republican convention. He was the guy that was in the wheelchair that stood up.
Yeah.
I stand for the flag. He had been in a car wreck, is how he ended up in a wheelchair. And so anyway, yeah, look, this is a should be a safe red seat. This is the kind of thing that makes me feel better about North Carolina. If you look at the House race polling just across the country, Trump is underperforming in a lot of key areas. This is a place that he did well in 2016. Cawthorn right now is losing to Mo Davis by 3 points. It's like 45-42, so a lot of undecideds. It's a red area. Like the undecideds could just kind of break home to Republicans there, I think, is his path to victory. But if he loses that seat, it's pretty much a sign also that Trump has lost North Carolina, and a sign that the Republicans are in deep trouble. I'm going from memory now. I think that's an R plus 11. So when you judge House districts for their partisan breakdown, you kind of look at voter registration. And I think there's 11% more Republicans than Democrats in the district. If Republicans are losing R plus 11 seats, the House majority that Nancy Pelosi will have in 2021 will be massive.
Okay, so nerd alert here. I've actually become really fascinated by these district level polls, and you know, Dave Wasserman has been doing this as well, showing the exact same thing: the underperformance of Republicans across the board. That you can kind of, as it's sort of a canary in the coal mine as you begin to look at these. If you paid attention back in 2016, that would have been an indication that maybe Trump was breaking through at this district level. All these district level polls seem to be suggesting a shift in the other direction right now. So, you know, we're going to see. By the way, we've gone through this entire podcast without talking about Joe Biden walking out on 60 Minutes.
Donald Trump walking out on 60 Minutes, you mean?
What did I say?
Joe Biden.
Oh my God! So,
all right, yeah, we're all starting to lose it.
I
mean, the whole thing is crazy to me. I mean, I watched most of the. So he puts up this leaked video on leaked or whatever. You know, they had taped the video as well. He puts this up on Facebook, all 35 minutes of it, and you know, he's petulant in it. He's upset about like the questions that are being asked, but they're pretty expected questions, as far as his answers are concerned, it was pretty standard Trump, just a little bit higher on the petulant scale. So yeah. I guess the strategy here was to try to negate what he expected would be bad coverage coming out of it Sunday, but he just drug it out. I thought that one thing that leaked out of it was that he, you know, basically said he hopes that Amy Coney Barrett,
yes,
rules to overturn Obamacare. Again, what a self-own on this leak. I mean, who knows if 60 Minutes was not going to air the whole 35-minute interview, right? They cut it up, and they're also doing Biden, and, you know, as is in the name of the show, it's only 60-minute show. So, you know, maybe some of this bad stuff hits the cutting room floor. So really strange strategy to put that out and draw attention to it.
Yeah, I mean, if you assume there's any strategy involved, it's Donald Trump standing up to the media, you know, pushing back against the elite media. It's all, you know, the Media Research Center, you know, toads are going to be all excited about all of this. But as you pointed out, he's raised the profile of the interview exponentially. Because, I mean, I can't remember the last time I actually watched 60 Minutes, to be honest with you, and now it's a must watch. He did come off looking petulant, and just that little tidbit where he's hoping the Supreme Court throws out Obamacare, that not only is that going to be a soundbite in, you know, millions of dollars worth of Democratic ads, but he gave them a 3-day head start on it. It's like they don't have to wait till Sunday, right? They have it. It's amazing. But also the way this began. What Leslie Stahl says, you ready for tough questions? Trump, just be fair. Leslie Stahl, last time you were like, bring it on. Trump, no, I'm not looking for that. Stahl, but you're okay with some tough questions. Trump, no, I'm not. He was petulant and pissed off.
And
when
then
he
multiple
in the
times,
room.
And then throughout the interview, he said, "I didn't say that." She asked her about. There's a good little now this video going around about all the times he said, "I didn't say that." And then the video of him saying it, and it was, you know, lock them all up, and regards to Gretchen Whitmer and all these other things. The whole time he's whining at the end of the interview, you know, you can see him. He cancels the Mike Pence part of it. He looks over at Mike, you know, Pence, and is like, "Mike, I mean, can you believe this? Can you believe this? No, we've done enough.
Yeah.
And it was. I mean, it's literally out of that. I don't know if anybody follows J.L. Colvin on Twitter. He does the best. Yeah. He does the best Trump impersonation, and he's got a shtick where he's always looking off screen at Mike, and like Trump is doing the J.L. Colvin shtick. It's not gonna. I guess to your point. You know, he figures he isn't going to get anything out of it because he knows how the interview was. So maybe you can get something out of it by just, you know, making it an anti-elite, anti-media thing. But boy, it feels like he's maxed out on that audience.
Exactly. So I don't think there's any strategy here. I just think that here's a guy who's probably starting to realize he's losing. He's, you know, he's always been thin-skinned. He's never been the warrior that he's portrayed himself as. And you had a moment of petulance. And so who knows? So, you know, and here we are 11 days out. Tim Miller, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast again. We have to make sure we do the, yeah, you come up with a hook for our live stream next week.
Okay. We'll work on it. Get everybody together with some bourbons and maybe go through the math. Maybe we can get nerdy.
You know, the bourbon thing is not just a prop, just so people actually know.
Oh, we know, Charlie.
Okay.
Let me know. I'm getting DMs all over the place. I hope Charlie has another bourbon.
Okay.
They're rooting you on out there.
I'm glad to hear that, because I poured myself a kind of a big one, although I paced myself through most of the night. So thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again. There are just 11 days to go until Election Day.